This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Muppets are back in theaters for the first time in 12 years. Their absence from the spotlight was far too long for our first guests, Jason Segel and Nick Stoller, creators of the new Muppet movie called The Muppets. Segel and Stoller first collaborated on the 2008 comedy Forgetting Sarah Marshall, in which Segel's character, a composer, put on a puppet rock opera about Dracula. The puppets he used were made by the Jim Henson Company, and the experience spurred him to approach Disney, who bought the Muppets in 2004, with a pitch for a new Muppet film. Segel and Stoller co-wrote the screenplay, and Segel stars as Gary, a Muppet superfan and brother to Walter, who is a Muppet. Gary and Walter, along with Gary's girlfriend, played by Amy Adams, help to reunite the Muppets, who've disbanded. Miss Piggy is working in Paris, Fozzie's performing in a Muppets cover band called the Moopits, and Gonzo is a plumbing magnate. Terry spoke with Jason Segel and Nick Stoller earlier this week.
Jason Segel, Nick Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air. I really enjoyed the film. Congratulations.
Thanks a lot. It's really nice to be back.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with the premise of the movie. And the premise is that Jason, that your younger brother is actually a Muppet who's having trouble finding his place in the world because he's never met another Muppet. He's never met anybody or anything like himself. How'd you come up with that as the premise?
Well, I mean, Nick and I came up with it together, but the character of Walter is sort of an analog for me in getting this Muppet movie made. He's a wild Muppet fan who, when he finds the Muppets, they're not, you know, the Muppets that he grew up with. And so he sets out to try to make them as famous as they once were, which is, that was sort of our goal in making this movie.
To rescue them from being washed up?
Yeah. Well, you know, comedy really moves in cycles. And I think that the kind of purity of the Muppets had been taken over by a more cynical sense of humor. And so we set out to make a Muppet movie that harkened back to like the late 70s, early 80s Muppets that we grew up with.
We also have been, you know, asking ourselves, like, where have the Muppets been? Why hasn't there been a Muppet movie in such a long time? And so we put those words into Walter's mouth.
And so in the story, so Jason, your character and your girlfriend, played by Amy Adams, are going to go to L.A., and Walter really wants to come and go to the Muppet studio, and you finally decide, okay, you're going to take him, and everybody's so happy you're all going to L.A. together. And then there's this great production number called Life's a Happy Song.
Yes.
And so, like, hundreds of people are down Main Street in Small Town USA, that's the name of the town, singing this song, and it is just really, like, so delightful. So before we hear the song, talk about asking Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords, he's one of the co-stars and co-writers of the songs in that show, to write this song. He did several original songs for the Muppets movie. What did you tell him you wanted from this opening production number?
Well, Nick and I had written a rough sketch of the idea of the production number, you know, when we were writing the script. And then when James Bobin came on to do the movie, he brought Brett McKenzie along with him. And James Bobin directed many of the Flight of the Conchords episodes, and he was one of the creators. We didn't have to tell Brett much in terms of tone because he's by nature very Muppety. The Flight of the Conchords themselves, it's a very Muppety kind of vibe. It's two wide-eyed innocents making their way through tough New York. And so he knew what to do with that number right from the start.
And in our initial meeting with James, I mean, I'd been friends with James for a few years, but in our initial meeting on this movie, he said the movie should open with a song that's about everything's great, but everything's not great.
But everything is kind of great.
Well, you know, hidden beneath the surface is Walter feeling like he doesn't quite belong in this town.
True.
And the Amy Adams character is feeling like our relationship is a bit stunted because of how close I am with Walter. So very, very subtly under the surface, we plant the seeds of the problems that are going to come up later in the film.
True to all that. Okay.
There's a subtle darkness to that song.
There's a subtle darkness to everything we do.
Okay. A very subtle darkness.
So here's Life's a Happy Song with its subtle darkness.
Yes.
Everything is great. Everything is grand. I got the whole wide world in the palm of my hand.
Everything is perfect. It's falling into place. I can't seem to wipe this smile off my face.
Life's a happy song.
And there's someone by my side to sing along. When you're alone, life can be a little rough. It makes you feel like you're 3 foot tall. When it's just you, well, times can be tough. When there's no one there to catch your fall.
So that's Life's a Happy Song from the soundtrack of the new Muppet movie, which is called The Muppets. And we heard Jason Segel and the voice of the new Muppet, Walter. So, Nick, you say that you already were friends with James Bobin, who directed your Muppets movie. And he not only did direct Flight of the Conchords, but he directed a lot of the Ali G show with Sacha Baron mm-hmm. Cohen. What I find so interesting about that is that you've taken guys who have really, like, adult humor. I mean, the Ali G show is pretty adult.
Sure.
Anything Sacha Baron Cohen does.
Yeah.
So, and you've put them in service of a family movie. And I think it's the kind of family movie that truly adults and children can enjoy. But it's interesting that you went with people who are really known for adult stuff and use them for, you know, the family musical.
Yeah, I mean, well, with James, you know, he's just Fly the Conchords. I think those musical numbers are just kind of amazingly staged, and he's such a brilliant and visual director, which usually doesn't go with comedy. And so it seemed as soon as he expressed interest, it was a no-brainer to, and we really were excited that he wanted to do it. But I think too that, like, at least in terms of our R-rated past, it's that there's kind of an essential sweetness to what, you know, we try to do, and so that's not that dissimilar to the Muppets. Even if in Sarah Marshall there's cursing and nudity and whatnot, we're still trying to get at something that's not cynical.
Yeah. I think also there's a misconception that a family film, it's sort of come to mean a children's film, and that's not what it has to be like. And so the Muppets have an inherent tone that it was never going to be dirty or raunchy, though I'm sure that some of the executives were nervous that we were doing the Muppets with a sense of irony. It doesn't take long to talk to us to realize that we had a pure love for the Muppets. It was helpful to have people, though, who weren't thinking of it as a kid's film, but who were thinking of it as a family comedy, and were trying to make it as funny as possible for everybody.
Let's play another song. And this is another great song that Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords wrote. And it's called Am I a Man or Am I a Muppet? And Jason, you sing half of the song, and Walter the Muppet sings the other half. Do you want to describe the premise?
Yes. This is about, you know, halfway through the film, if not a little later, and Walter and I, who are as close as can be, are starting to drift apart because Walter is realizing that he needs to be with the Muppets, and I'm realizing that I should probably grow up and further my relationship with Amy Adams, and we're having a hard time breaking away from each other. This was one of my favorite things I've ever done in my career. I think this song is so funny.
It is really funny. So you sing it, and the new Muppet that you've created for this movie, Walter, sings it too. So here it is.
Am I a man or am I a Muppet?
Am I a Muppet?
If I'm a Muppet, then I'm a very manly Muppet.
Very manly Muppet.
Am I a Muppet?
Muppet.
Or am I a man?
Am I a man?
If I'm a man, that makes me a Muppet of a man.
A Muppet of a man.
I look into these eyes, and I don't recognize the one I see inside. It's time for me to decide, am I a man or am I a Muppet?
Am I a Muppet?
If I'm a Muppet, well, I'm a very manly Muppet.
Here I go again, I'm always running out of time. I think I've made up my mind.
That's Man or Muppet, featuring Jason Segel and the new Muppet Walter, voiced by Peter Lentz, from the Muppets soundtrack. Jason Segel and Nick Stoller co-wrote the new Muppets movie and spoke with Terry Gross last week.
So when you got access to the Muppets for the movie, were there like was there like a book of guidelines that you were handed in order to like, you know, honor the Muppets' legacy and work within the rules of the Muppet Kingdom and everything?
You know, I think there are a set of rules that you know, that the puppeteers kind of explained to us as we were working on the script. And so, you know, in our earliest draft, Jason's character Gary and Walter he was a ventriloquist on the Venice Beach boardwalk, and Walter was his puppet, and they had this amazing act, and then you reveal that Walter's actually alive and wants to be a Muppet. And the puppeteers explained to us that we couldn't that in the world, Muppets think of themselves as people. They're not puppets. They're not, you know, Kermit's a frog. He's not a puppet. And that would kind of break one of the kind of cardinal rules of the world. And so we changed that very quickly to what, you know, to what's in the current. So there are a lot of kind of rules like that make the world whole.
And then there are rules that you know viscerally if you love the Muppets. Like, the Muppets are never mean to people. The Muppets don't get laughs at other people's expense. It's part of what I really loved about the Muppets is they don't even want to destroy their villains, for example. They want to reform their villains. In the first Muppet movie, Doc Hopper, played by Charles Durning, wants to cut off Kermit's legs and make frog's legs. And as opposed to destroy him, Kermit is like, well, maybe you should think about why you don't have friends and, you know, maybe you're just lonely and you need to be a happier person. I mean, it's like the Muppets are pure.
Okay, so in order to create Muppets that could be deceitful and nasty, you have like this cover band that you created called the Muppets.
Yes.
And it's, you know, like you describe it, because I don't even know what language to use now.
Yeah, they are, you're right, they're the only way that you could create Muppets that were bad was to literally do like the comic book style bizarro Muppets. So they're the exact opposite of the Muppets. They're Kermoot, Foozie, Rolf, and Animal. And they are the evil version of the Muppets. You're right, actually, they're the only evil Muppets I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And so they're the big threat is that Tex Richmond, played by Chris Cooper, who's just an absolute genius, has potential to get the rights to the Muppet name, and his plan is to replace the Muppets with this evil, cynical version of the Muppets called the Moopits.
And the Moopits have been working basically as a cover band. You know how a lot of old bands have like one member of the original band and the rest are all just musicians that they picked up. So it's a band like
That's
this,
right.
Like one of the real Muppets is in the band, but everybody else
yeah.
is like a Muppet.
And
the everybody like and all the Muppets are really like they're mean, they're nasty, they're cynical. And so the song that they're singing in this, they're at like they're a lounge act at a casino. Is it Reno or Vegas? I can't remember.
It's Reno, and it's called Pachulo Casino. And Fozzie Bear, the consummate performer, is the only remaining member of the Muppets performing in this band, and he's taken all of the original beautiful Muppet songs and has changed the lyrics so that they describe the Pachulo Casino specials and hotel deals.
And this is like a very sacrilegious thing to do in Muppet
it
world.
Is.
So therefore, let's hear the Muppet version of the Rainbow Connection, which is basically an ad for this hotel in whose lounge they are performing.
Why are there such great deals on our hotel room? Continental breakfast is free.
It is free.
HBO in every room. And free gas if you check in afternoon. Free parking for cars, not RVs.
Not RVs.
Our wedding chapel is 24 hours. No marriage certificate is needed.
No marriage certificate is needed.
We're glad you found it. Pachulo Casino. The owners, the Muppets,
and me. Cha-cha-cha. The Thank you. You're a great audience.
So that's the Muppets, the Muppet cover band of like bad guy Muppets from the soundtrack of the new movie, The Muppets. My guest, Jason Segel and Nick Stoller, wrote the movie. Jason Segel stars in it. And tell me more about what the Muppets meant to you as kids. Like how, like which were your favorite characters?
I mean, the as being a comedy writer, comedy director, general comedy nerd, they're kind of the first thing I watched that made me say I want to do that. I remember as a kid, and the Muppets kind of very quickly lead to watching Saturday Night Live and Monty Python and all of those other shows. But it's the first thing you watch as a kid that.
Yeah, for people who don't remember, the Muppets used to be in the first season of Saturday Night Live. The Muppets were regulars.
Right. Yeah, and they also I think really set the stage for the Simpsons and for the Pixar movies and for a lot of comedy. Family comedy in particular that appeals to both kids and adults. That's that's a little bit more complicated than just something that just appeals to kids.
Now I've read, and a lot of people might have read this too, that there's a couple of people who performed Muppets in the past who think that this movie kind of like violates some Muppet traditions, and particularly because there's like a whoopee cushion joke, so it's kind of like a fart joke. It's a whoopee cushion. So did you get any criticisms like that from the inside, from the Muppet family?
I think more than anything, they were they made those comments before they saw the film. I think that they were just nervous about what we were going to do. One of our producers put it best. We're by definition the step-parent in this, and no matter how good the step-parent is, the kids are always going to be skeptical of them and give them a hard time. I think that now that they've seen the film, they feel embarrassed that they made those comments because you saw the movie, Terry. It's like it's such a love letter to the Muppets.
Also, in our one previous collaboration, you did show your penis.
Right.
So they had reason. They had reason to be a little nervous.
Yeah, I mean, that's forgetting Sarah Marshall. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that literally is what they were nervous about, that these R-rated guys were going to come in and sort of try to reinvent the Muppets or something like that. And there's no reinvention going on here. It's, if anything, we're trying to harken back to the Muppets that we loved and get things back on course.
I'm not going to lie. We had endless hours of discussion about the Farch Jews joke. And it's such a Fozzie joke,
Yeah.
We're not saying the fart in and of himself, the fart sound in and of itself is funny. It's the fact that he thinks it's funny that's the joke.
That joke came down to such an issue of semantics of them saying, like, well, it's fine if he calls them whoopee shoes, but Fozzie would never say fart shoes. I mean, it got down to this weird issue of semantics where it seemed like maybe there was more going on than just them being upset about this joke.
That must have been. I wish I had a transcript of that conversation.
Yeah, it was at some point Nick and I are looking at each other and like, this is a disagreement about something different.
So what do you think it was really about?
Oh, I just think that they were nervous a little bit about new blood coming in, and justifiably so. Like Nick said, we were coming from very different, beginnings than they were coming from. But I think that when they see the film, they see that we were all on the same page.
I also think I didn't realize until, working on the movie, how much the puppeteers have lived and breathed Muppets for, 30 years. Steve Whitmire's worked on this for 30 years. And so I, if I'd worked on something for 30 years and two guys came in and said, we're doing the next thing, I would certainly have my backup,
So now that you've created a new Muppet, Walter, does he get to live with the Muppet family now? Does he have a Muppet life?
I think that's the plan for Walter. I think by the end of the film, Walter is fully realized as a Muppet. So unfortunately, we have to send him off into the world. Let him be all grown up.
He made his choice in Man or Muppet.
That's right, yeah.
He made the choice.
And Jason Segel, you have your own puppets. In Forgetting Sarah Marshall, you put on a vampire musical.
Yes.
Did you want to smuggle any of your puppets into the Muppet movie and have any of your puppets meet the Muppets and perform together?
We really wanted to have, or I really wanted, I don't know if anyone else really cared, but I really wanted Dracula and Angel from Sarah Marshall to make an appearance in the Muppet Telethon. But We were not able to make that happen, unfortunately, for various legal reasons. But, they exist now together in my house. So anyone who wants to come over and see them all interact together, you're more than welcome.
They're appearing nightly.
Yeah.
Wait, you have Muppets in your house now?
I was given my new favorite possession. I was given the Jason Segel Muppet. For when I look in the mirror in the song Man vs. Muppet, I see a reflection of myself that is a Muppet. And they let me keep that. So that's in my house now.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. It's very exciting. I play with it a lot. No joke.
Oh, that's great. Are you learning how to work him by looking at yourself in the mirror?
Yeah, yes, I am.
You have the remote control?
Yeah, it's also radio controlled. That's an option on it. So occasionally I'll have people
like
over.
Like a car, it's an option.
Yeah, so I'll have people over, and then I'll walk out of the room, and I'll make the Jason Segel puppet come to life and make people talk to that for a while. And you keep asking why I'm still single, Terry.
Well, I wish you both the best. I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be on your show again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Nick Stoller and Jason Segel co-wrote The Muppets, now out in theaters. Segel also stars in the film. They spoke with Terry Gross earlier this week.
It's time to get things started
on the most sensational, inspirational, celebrational, Muppetational. This is what we call the Muppet Show.
Boogie Woogie was a piano style that started sometime in the early 20th century and by the 1930s became a huge pop music fad. After World War II, it reemerged in country music, where it was an important precursor to rock and roll. Rock historian Ed Ward has that story today.
We know now that starting with Western swing in the 1920s, country music reflections of popular black music has a long history, so that claiming that Elvis Presley was the first successful fusion of the two is just silly. The hillbilly boogie fad, however, has been largely overlooked in that history, although there were hundreds of records made in that style. It started with a guy named Arthur Smith in 1945. Guitar Boogies by Arthur Smith's Hot Quintet, a band which had been backing a singer and recorded it as a goof when there was some time remaining in the recording session. A straight-ahead boogie-woogie performed on guitar, it became a hit, and for the rest of his life, Arthur was billed as Arthur Guitar Boogie Smith. Post-war country music must have been ripe for guitar virtuosos because suddenly they were everywhere.
About 12 o'clock, gonna close the door, can't nobody come or nobody go. I got a boogie-woogie feeling, had it all night long. That feeling my mama won't let me come home.
One of the most influential was Merle Travis, who was from Kentucky, and learned a lot of his guitar style from his barber, Ike Everly, who had a family radio show featuring his sons. Travis was not only a solo performer, he was also in demand as a studio musician.
I love that Mobile Boogie. I like to travel when I'm heading for home, way down in Dixie where I'll never more roam. I know a girl who's been waiting around, she likes to boogie boogie when I'm in town. I mean Mobile, down in Alabama, where the breeze is blowing, that's where I'm bound.
It's hard to tell, but it's likely Travis is the third guitar behind Alton and Raybon Delmore, the Delmore brothers here. The Delmores recorded dozens of boogies, which revived a career they'd started in the 30s. With the addition of Travis and banjo player Grandpa Jones, they became the gospel-singing Browns Ferry Four, and Travis's ability to play the bass with one finger while picking a melody at the same time, called Travis picking, came out of his boogie period and revolutionized American guitar playing. By the end of the 40s, Travis had moved to Hollywood and joined the New Capitol label, which was recording West Coast country talent, and the boogie craze was in full swing. Travis was in the studio band for the genre's biggest hits, including this one.
Dad stands in the corner with the barrel so straight. I look out the window and over the gate. The big fat rabbits are jumping in the grass. Wait till they hear my old shotgun blast. Shotgun boogie, I done saw your track. Look out, Mr. Rabbit, when I cock my hammer back. Well, over on the ridge is a scaly bark. Hickory nuts are big, you can see them in the dark. The big fat squirrels, they scratch and they fight. I'll be on that ridge before daylight with the shotgun boogie. All I need is one shot. Look out, bushy tail, tonight you'll be in the pot.
Shotgun Boogie, sung by Tennessee Ernie Ford, was a number one country hit at the end of 1950 and pretty much represented the height of the hillbilly boogie craze. But it also pointed out a growing division in country music. The war had brought lots of people from Texas and Oklahoma to California, and Capitol was only one of the labels recording a new kind of country music. In fact, the music business term country and western was accurate. This music was at least as much western as country, which was Nashville's specialty. Capitol studio musicians were second to none. Along with Merle Travis, they had Telecaster virtuoso Jimmy Bryant and steel guitarist Speedy West, whose instrumental albums wowed other musicians, as well as more open-minded jazz fans. Stayed more traditional and more acoustic during the early 1950s, and the gap between the two coasts just widened as time went on. By the time Elvis came along, making his first records with an acoustic guitar in Tennessee, Hillbilly Boogie was history, and Los Angeles was mixing country and pop, waiting for a new country generation to come along. But that's a story for another day.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. Coming up, we'll listen to an excerpt of an interview with Francis Ford Coppola, recorded at this year's Toronto International Film Festival. This is Fresh Air Weekend. One of the highlights of the 2011 Toronto International Film Festival last September was an onstage conversation with Francis Ford Coppola. Our producer Lauren Krenzel enjoyed it and thought you would too. We'll hear an excerpt of Francis Ford Coppola's conversation with the co-director of the festival, Cameron Bailey. And we'll hear some questions from the audience. This In Conversation event was part of the festival's Maverick series. Coppola is the director of the Godfather films, The Conversation, Apocalypse Now, One from the Heart, The Outsiders, and The Cotton Club. His new film Twixt had its world premiere last September at Toronto. Here Coppola is responding to a question about why he persisted in making Apocalypse Now after he had to spend so much of his own money to finance the film, and when it seemed no one in Hollywood wanted to make a movie about the Vietnam War.
you know, if I told you the reason, you just die laughing. I thought that we could make this great big hit war movie, Apocalypse Now, and make a lot of money and then make little art films for the rest of our lives. You know, that if we made a real Hollywood blockbuster like A Bridge Too Far or one of those, The Guns of Navarone, and that it certainly had the ingredients and the extraordinary tapestry of what that movie was going to be, I thought they were just all wrong.
That's amazing, because that film, Apocalypse Now, seems like it's completely the opposite of that. It is, to me anyhow, it seems so critical of that military endeavor as opposed to a rousing war movie.
Well, it took me on a journey, to say the least, and when I actually started making the film, I mean, a lot of times you enter a film with youthful enthusiasm, oh yeah, 50 helicopters, I can do that. I had no idea how to do that, and so I went with my unit and stayed there. We were supposed to be there less than a year. We ended up being there 2 years, and even stylistically, I was painting myself into a corner, and I didn't realize it. In other words, as I made the film, I was making the film in a much more surrealistic way, or I was, you know, available to the imagery I saw and all those colored smoke grenades and strange, surreal aspects. And as I started making the film, I was just following my nose. You know, and I had this little green volume of the Heart of Darkness in my pocket. I filled it with notes, and I was using that more as a script. I knew the script, the John Milius script, really well. And the film just sort of took me on a very surreal journey, and in a sense, it's to my credit that I allowed it to happen. But I was pretty scared. I was, you know, I was betting the family farm. Creatively, I had no idea how to end it.
Can you talk a little bit about those final scenes in Apocalypse Now? I assume most of you have seen Apocalypse Now in the room. So this won't be a spoiler. The scenes with Brando, I understand he came to the Philippines not having prepared.
Brando, the deal with Brando was 3 weeks for $3 million. But he had promised me that he was going to be a little thinner than he was when I last saw him in L.A. Because, you know, the issue was if he was a runaway Green Beret officer, it sounds silly, but what kind of uniform should he wear? They don't make size XXXXX Green Beret uniform, you know. So when he showed up on the location where we were, he was much bigger than he had been even when he said he would lose weight. And I was just thinking, Pat, what kind of uniform should I get for him, you know? So here I had the problem of I had to dress him somehow. So I suggested to him, I said, well, why don't we, like, cut your hair off and do him like Kurtz in the Conrad. Those of you who know the Conrad, Kurtz is a very vivid, you know, skull-like apparition in the Belgian Congo. So he said, no, that won't work. So we spent, of the 3 weeks I had, we spent the first week just sitting in this it was like a houseboat, like a trailer, but it was a houseboat, just discussing termites and insects. And Brando was, beyond being such a great actor, he was a genius man. I mean, the things he would talk about were so interesting and fascinating. Of course, I was panicking because every day there'd be a knock on the door. Well, Francis, I guess we'll go to lunch now. You're not going to come out and shoot. I said, no.
The crew's waiting for you the whole time.
Yeah. And we only had 15 days. And so basically, to put it in a nutshell, we had used up the first 5 days just talking like this. So finally, on the Friday, I walked in, and there is Brando with his hair shaved, bald. And I said, but Marlon, you said it wouldn't work. And he says, well, you read it, I said. And he says, no, I lied. I never read it. I read it last night. So he read it last night and came around to this image. And then what I did basically is on film, a very big man, like I'm a big man, but if you would have photographed me, you wouldn't know whether I was fat or just like tall and gigantic, because you tend to see the shoulders. And so I had the idea to dress him in black pajamas and get a double who was like 6'7", be him, and play him more as a giant than as a fat person. And that's the way I got around the uniform issue.
And the dialogue between his character and Martin Sheen's, once they're in the jungle and it's just a face-off between the two of them, how much of that was scripted? How much of that was...
It was all scripted. There was a lot of... many, many hours through the night working on those last scenes. But a lot of what we were talking, what I was talking about with Brando, of course, I was recording, and then I would bring it back to him in a form of a monologue or something. And Brando tended to have like a bad memory. I'm convinced his acting style is based on that. You know, when he goes, well, I don't know. He is literally trying to remember the line. And he's a master of using cue cards and what have. So what I would do is I would have him recite the monologue that was derived from these hours of discussion about insects as well as other things. And then he had these long monologues, and he had a little tape recorder in his pocket, and he could just like play it and hear the line, and then he could say the line. Like, that's how he... how he could remember those speeches.
It's amazing. You've tempted me to begin talking about the Godfather films now with once we're talking
about old movies. Let's talk about movies they're going to make.
Okay, all right. Listen, there's a lot of ways we can go, but yes, let's open it up to
you.
I
want it to be useful to them.
Do we have microphones? Okay, someone right here in the back who put their hand up first.
Thank you for joining us today. It's a big honor to speak with you. My question has to do with working with actors. It's very intimidating for young filmmakers to think that they can work with some A-list Hollywood actor. What's your approach? I mean, obviously you've worked with some the biggest actors around, but what's the sort of the secret to working with actors, with just to sort of, so you overcome that intimidation?
Right. Well, you know, when I started out, I was working with some important actors and or actors I believed in, and I wasn't. I had no credentials. I didn't have any clout, as it was. One tradition I always pulled from theater is I always try to get a week or 2 weeks rehearsal period, which is not common for film, mainly because it's so hard to get all the actors together in one place. But I always fought for it. And this is a time when you work with the actor. You're not reading the script or like rehearsing the lines. You don't do that at all. You read it once on the first day. Maybe you read the script twice, once straight through, and then once in the afternoon where people can bring up their objections or their ideas and do a sort of start and stop. But after that, I never went back to the text. I always worked with the actors based on improvisations or theater games, sometimes very elaborate improvisations that had a sensual component. By that I mean where they would eat food together or they would prepare lunch. Somehow when you're doing an improvisation and you're playing you're playing at a character that you don't really know, you're not really that person yet, it's very helpful to have something, you know, like make a sandwich or something, eat food or do things that involve the senses that can help you. And I've had great luck with improvisations, group improvisations. On the first Godfather, the very first gathering of the actors when they were all going to meet Brando, and of course all those young men in The Godfather, Brando was like the Godfather. I mean, he was such a legendary figure. But it was in the back of a restaurant. I had set up a family-type Italian dinner table, and I had Brando sitting at the head like the father, and to his right was Pacino, you know, who was trying to impress Brando with how silent and intense he could be. And and to the left was Jimmy Caan. I'm trying to impress Brando with how funny he was. And then Duval was just kind of, every time Brando wasn't looking, he was doing Brando imitations. And Johnny Casale was there in his being shy and kind of the character that he ultimately played. But my sister Tally was serving the food. And I found that after, you know, as I say, it's hard to do that. You know, it's easy to break character and just, you know, fool around. But if you ask the actors to really try to stay in character, it's very exerting work, like any kind of exercise. And I found that after that dinner, they were a family and they were already partly in character. And this has happened to me many times in rehearsals where we did that. And you have to realize a very important thing. Working with actors, if they're someone's difficult or doesn't like the script or the lines or is late all the time or all the bad behavior you heard about, it all stems from the fact that they're scared. So the rehearsal period where they're not really on the line, you know, actors have to do a tremendously, they have to give a performance, but they don't have a violin or a viola to be between them and the audience. They are the violin. So you have to love them for what they do and admire them and want to give them every little edge you can. And I found that by giving them those few days of, you know, being off the hook, not really, one by one, they sort of click into character. For years, I thought what it was is that if you give the actors the time, that they eventually become the characters. And recently, as I thought about it, I realized I'm wrong, that one by one, the characters become the actor, because it's the actor that's the flesh and blood person, and the character inhabits the flesh and blood person. And a rehearsal gives them that opportunity.
I just had a quick question. You had early success as a writer when you wrote the screenplay for Patton, won an Academy Award for that. What kept you on the track to become a director as opposed to just pursuing more writing?
When I wrote Patton, at the time I was about 24, and I only got the job because when they asked me if I had military experience, I said yes, and I had gotten kicked out of military school, which was my experience. So Burt Lancaster was going to play the part at the time that I was actually there. And they called me in for a meeting, and they just lambasted the script I wrote because it had this bizarre opening where he stands up in front of a big, theoretically, his battalion of men and gives this speech. And they criticized that because he was presented as a four-star general and with his Colt revolvers and those artifacts were all things he had gathered during the war. They thought it was misleading to start that way. And then they didn't like the, there were a lot of sequences in the script of kind of reincarnation where he talked about roaming through the Carthaginian in battle and as though he had been there. And they thought it was the script was a little kind of metaphysical. At any rate, long and the short, but mainly over the beginning, they didn't pick up my option and I went on and they weren't going to use my script. What happened was 4 or 5 years later, they revisited it and they had hired George C. Scott, and Scott didn't like the script they then had. And someone remembered this earlier script, so they went back to my script, and that's how I got to be in it. So the moral I want to teach all the young people here is that the same thing you get fired for is what they give you Lifetime Achievement Awards 30 years later.
I'm sure there are many Godfather fans here, and I just want to say over the last few decades, I've heard rumors about another sequel. I've heard Andy Garcia's Godfather story being told with young Sonny Corleone. I was just wondering, can you share any conversations you've had with Paramount or anybody for that matter about a new sequel?
Well, you know, when I did The Godfather, I didn't think that it made sense for there to be a second one. And, you know, it had done what it was supposed to do according to that. So I was very reluctant, and I could tell you very funny stories about Paramount's, in those days, Paramount used their attempt to have a second film.
Why don't you do that?
Well, you know, I had said at the time of the first one, absolutely, I do not want to do another Godfather film. I don't see it. I don't understand why there should be one. The story is over. You know, he lied to his wife. He's become the new Don. I mean, what's there more to tell? And they just, you know, it was making so much money. They were so anxious. I said, tell you what I'll do. I will produce one for you and try to help, and I will choose a young filmmaker who I feel can do it, and that was okay for a while. And you know, 6 months went by, and I went to Charlie Bluthorn, who was the owner of Paramount at that time, and I said, "All right, I'm ready. I have an idea for possibly, and the director is Martin Scorsese." And Bob Evans said, "No, absolutely not. That's crazy. That's the craziest thing I ever heard." Ultimately, they said to me, okay, Francis, let's talk turkey. What will it take to get you to make another Godfather? And I said, all right. I said, the three conditions. Well, meanwhile, I had decided, you know, I was interested in this, in a film that took a father and a son at the same age and sort of paralleled their lives. So I thought what I could do is possibly just apply what was like an art film to The Godfather and do the same thing. If I could figure out who could possibly play Marlon Brando as a young man, which was not as easy as it seemed at the time, you know. So Bluehorn said to me, okay, anything you want. I said, okay, three things. I want $1 million. That just seemed to be like a good thing to say. Second, I said, I want Robert Evans to have absolutely nothing. He can't read the script. He can't comment. He can't come to the set. He's got zero to do with it. And, you know, Robert Evans is not a man, is a man with some talent, by the way. You know, they're the most dangerous. And the third thing was, I want to call it The Godfather Part 2. Well, they said, well, the first two we can do, but this, we're very concerned about the idea of calling this The Godfather Part 2. I said, well, what could possibly be wrong with that? He said, well, many people are going to think it's the second half of the movie they already saw. I said, why would they do that? They don't think War and Peace Part 2 is, you know, the movie. So that was the stickler for a while, the fact that I wanted to call it Part 2. When I think of what that simple decision did to movies, where everything became Part 2, Part 5, Part 3. So that's how I got into doing The Godfather Part 2.
Francis Ford Coppola before an audience at this year's Toronto International Film Festival. We want to thank the festival and Francis Ford Coppola for allowing us to broadcast this recording. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.